Hello everyone, I'm Laila Hamidi, and for our very first unique podcast series on vulnerabilities, which is all about those segments of society who need us the most, I have with me Ms. Marvi Maimon, a former social protection minister from Pakistan, twice parliamentarian and foremost an international humanitarian. Today we will be discussing the issue of acid violence, how it presents a global challenge, how it creates vulnerabilities in the system, and what is being done worldwide to curb it. Acid violence is a form of violent assault which involves the act of throwing acid or another corrosive substance onto the body of another with the intention to disfigure, maim, torture, or kill. On the whole, it is a form of violence which disproportionately affects women and can therefore be considered an act of gender-based violence. It reflects the discriminatory attitudes towards women and girls which permeate societies the world over. This is evident because typically it occurs when women are felt to have transgressed, quote-unquote, traditional gender rules and norms. Ms. Maimon's 2011 legislation on acid violence made history for Pakistan and set into motion international legislation of a similar nature by ensuring life imprisonment for the culprits. Saving Face, which was the documentary made on the legislation and the lives of victims, won Pakistan its very first Oscar. Ms. Maimon has since been active on curbing this heinous hate crime and has seen the challenges from close up. Ms. Maimon, welcome to today's podcast on vulnerabilities. Let me start by just asking you about your personal story with the cause of acid violence. How did it start for you?
Thank you, Laila. Actually, my journey on acid started in 2009 when I, as parliamentarian, started visiting the vulnerable women who were victims of this crime in very far-flung villages and towns of Pakistan. And at that time, I noticed what you have mentioned, that this crime seemed reserved for those women who had somehow said no to men, no to marriage proposals, no to advances, no to their fundamental freedoms being curtailed. And what struck me was how permanent the damage of the victims were. They essentially destroyed the women, either physically killing them with the burns, or killing their being whilst being physically alive as such. The disfigurement was so violent that it left women literally dead, even if they were physically still alive. It was a form of violence which was swift, easy to carry out with seemingly little consequences for the culprit. So having seen such incidences, I finally reached the deathbed of Maria, who was from Shikarpur, Sindh, Pakistan. And she was on the Burns Hospital bed in Karachi. And as I sat next to her, she said three simple words: get him punished. I promised her that day I would. And as I walked out of the hospital, I knew that Maria would not live to see the day I would accomplish that. But her last words to me gave me the strength to see the entire legislative process through. So as a first-time parliamentarian, Laila, I must admit that I did not realize how long such a simple legislation could actually take. So from getting a team of lawyers together to draft the initial bill, to introducing it on the floor of the National Assembly of Pakistan, to making the case for it in the parliamentary committee, to politically ensuring consensus across party lines, cross parties, all parties, through the Women Caucus on the same, to fighting for the cause in media, to being part of the documentary that you mentioned, to getting it passed from the National Assembly, to then getting it passed from the upper house, the Senate, and then for it actually becoming law, took a good 2 years. It wasn't such a simple process as you can see. And I'm sure in other countries, it is probably similar. It takes time, a legislation. So during this time, I must admit that I visited many other victims and I assured them that I would get them justice. After the law was passed, the journey of its implementation started. And that was a second phase, if you like, ensuring that each culprit was duly punished. Then the journey actually moved to its final stage, which was the second legislation in 2016, when I tried to introduce an improved version of the first legislation in the same assembly. That took me about 2 years, and just before our tenure in the Assembly and the government, our government tenure ended in 2018, that was actually passed by the National Assembly of Pakistan. But unfortunately, it expired because it never reached the Senate and then it never became law. So that is, if you like, an unfinished business that needs to be taken up by future parliamentarians of Pakistan. But as far as my particular struggle on this particular issue is concerned, that struggle has continued, and I've been engaging on the subject internationally so that our legislation is passed on and other countries can emulate it. And they have, in fact. It's been over a decade of being part of this asset crime legislation and this asset crime journey, if you like. But there's so much more to do because the numbers speak for themselves. There has been a visible decrease in the crime. But like I said, we're not out of the red on this one globally, nor are we out of the red on this one as far as Pakistan is concerned, because frankly, the legislation has to be fine-tuned. The implementation has to be ensured. And there's so many more things. And I think we will discuss that in this podcast.
Wow, that's quite a journey. That's extremely moving. I do want to ask, though, do you think that, do you see this as a problem beyond Pakistan's borders as well? Do you think it presents a global challenge?
Yes, I think it does, definitely. Like I said, it because this is widespread. It's not just restricted to any developing countries, just the developing countries of the global south, like India, Pakistan. I mean, it goes beyond the South Asian context, and it goes into the other continents as well. I mean, Colombia, the numbers are high. Even UK, the numbers are pretty high on this one. And Cambodia, etc., Nepal. These are some of the countries that have seen the highest incidences of acid attacks. But they're not. It's not just limited to these countries. So you can see it's across the continents issue. And it reflects really a deep-rooted societal gender imbalance, traditions of hyper-masculinity, and violent forms of female repression, which are all pervasive of global problems. And acid attacks really cause immediate and long-term harm to victims. Victims experience, like I said, lifelong disfigurement. They go through a lot of medical complications, a lot of financial distress as a result of this. And of course, social exclusion and psychological trauma. And acid and other corrosive substances are really very readily and cheaply available globally, unfortunately. And this is the actual problem which needs to be tackled by everyone, by all stakeholders on the subject. And the ease of access and carrying this as a weapon, it's become like a weapon. I mean, it's not a bullet, but in a way, a bullet can take a life. So this can take a life as well, and this can go beyond that. It takes a life even when you're living, because you're half dead when you're living with those kind of disfigurements. And it becomes very difficult to curtail such incidences. Now, globally, the common denominator is that there are numerous barriers to justice for victims. I just want to, discuss that. It's basically, it's a crime which goes unreported for many reasons, including, the survivor's fear of reprisal or for reporting the attacks. Lack of information about who to report to in certain cases in certain countries, how to go about it, your own rights, social stigmatization, corrupt or simply inefficient legal and police systems in so many countries. So in many ways, it's impossible to know the true extent of its prevalence in societies. I mean, we do have numbers internationally on this. But I'm pretty sure that they're all underreported because, like I explained, a lot of this goes not just unpunished, it goes underreported and then it goes unpunished.
Okay, so it seems like an incredibly complex form of violence. Would you say that acid violence is sufficiently addressed in international and national legislation?
Laila, I'd say it's yes and no. It's not a perfect situation because under international law, states have a due diligence obligation to prevent such acts of violence from occurring, protect victims, to punish perpetrators, and provide compensation and support to all those who have been affected. But since acid violence falls under the category of violence against women, it can be seen as encompassed within numerous international conventions and obligations. And this would, of course, include the 1993 Vienna World Conference on Human Rights, which officially acknowledged that all forms of violence against women are human rights violations. CEDAW, of course, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and et cetera, et cetera. So it does come under the general sort of umbrella of violence against women, but in terms of national legislations of numerous countries, things have become more specific. And things needed to get more specific in terms of law, because otherwise they were kind of, escaping the punishment part of it. And I want to give you a few case studies which we have seen whilst we've been lobbying for better legislation on the subject internationally. I want to take Bangladesh to start with. Bangladesh started off with the 2002 Acid Crime Control Act, the ACCA. And this allows courts to impose the death penalty, in fact, for acid attacks. The level of punishment is tied to parts of the body which are affected. So if the victim dies or loses sight of or hearing, or if the victim's face or sexual organs or other parts of the body are damaged, the attacker faces the death penalty or life imprisonment, as well as a fine of up to about $1,400 approximately. And if the attack maims any other part of the body, the attacker faces 7 to 14 years of imprisonment. So as you can see, it's a cascading down kind of an effect, and it's linked to what has been affected in terms of the damage on the body. And it regulates, monitors, and the use and the sale, purchase, the storage, transportation, import, and export of acid. This part of it is important because this is something which has escaped many other national legislations. Now, if you come to India, there's a Criminal Law Amendment Act of 2013, which apparently provides for punishment for perpetrators of acid attacks. And the Indian Penal Code, Section 326A, the minimum punishment on this is 10 years imprisonment. And if you come to UK, as of 2017, it's become unlawful to carry acid with the intent to cause harm. And attacks are prosecuted as acts of actual bodily harm and grievous bodily harm. In 2018, there were new guidelines published by the Sentencing Council. And adults convicted of carrying a corrosive substance in public for a second time will be given a minimum 6-month jail term. And under 18s are handed over a 4-month detention and training orders. Now, these guidelines match those already in place for knives, imposing the same minimum sentences for anyone convicted of threatening someone with acid or other offensive weapons. Then there's the 2019 Offensive Weapons Act, as far as the UK is concerned. And those are provisions for crimes related to acid attacks. It includes bringing in greater regulation of the sale of acid and corrosive products, and making it an offense to carry a corrosive substance in a public place without good reason. I'd like to come to Cambodia now, Laila. And in Cambodia, there's a 2012 acid law which requires state hospitals to provide medical care free of charge for acid attacks survivors. If we move over to Colombia, we've seen that there's a 2016 law which those who use any type of chemical agent, again, you see the language is different in many countries, but they're basically getting at the same thing because they're talking about all these corrosive substances. So the use of any type of chemical agent to attack someone will receive between 12 to 20 years of jail time. And the sentence can increase up to 50 years in prison for those who permanently disfigure their victim, as the majority of acid attacks actually do permanently disfigure. So this is, again, linked to the disfigurement, complete disfigurement. And now let's finally come to Pakistan. And I have kind of briefed you initially that we had the first one, which was the 2011 Acid Control and Crime Prevention Act. And that amended the Pakistan Penal Code and Criminal Procedure Code to specifically punish those perpetrators of acid crimes. And in addition to that, we had Article 336A and 336B to the Penal Code. And A extended the definition of hurt. And B basically states punishment of at least 14 years up to life imprisonment and minimum fine of 1 million rupees. Now, I had mentioned that we went into a second bill, which was the 2017 Acid and Burn Crime Bill, which has not seen, it's still a bill and it got expired. And so this has not become law, but I do want to talk about this because this was talking about giving free medical treatment and rehabilitation for victims. This is extremely important, this part of it. This takes care of the cycle after the attack. Not just in terms of the culprits getting, behind the bars, but in terms of what happens to the victims, because the victims need this kind of treatment and rehab. And it also outlines trial procedure to ensure proper and timely action. It allocated funds for victims and legal processes, created a acid and burn crime monitoring board. Now, this unfortunately has not been passed, but there's a lot of elements of this which can in the future be used by many countries, and I hope that that countries do use this model. Now, I hope this gives you a sense of the type of issues the different national legislations face out there. Of course, each country is tailoring the basic punishment to meet its own particular legal traditions on the subject. There can't be complete uniformity, but it would be fair to assume that there's a greater sensitivity worldwide. Number one, this is not just a South-South issue. This goes beyond just Global South, because you've seen, I've given you the UK numbers as well. It's pretty high in the UK and other countries around the globe. Second, that whilst this is mostly prevalent in what we would assume to be cotton-growing countries, because there the access to acid is used to clean cotton. So the access to acid is a bit easier in cotton-growing countries. It's not just restricted to cotton-growing countries. Number three, that acid is being seen as an easily carried and undetectable weapon of first resort. Now, this is extremely dangerous, and this is something the world needs to really, when you think of crimes taking place, and when you think of how far-reaching the impact on one individual of that one crime is, this is the basic problem. And number four, that the intentions of the culprit are permanent, violent, damage and death. This is also an important point, because this basically explains the violent side of the crime. That, you know, if someone can feel so much hatred of want to destroy somebody so badly, it's not just death. It's in fact death multiplied, because you're actually, in many ways, like I said earlier, and I will be repeating this, because you're actually half dead, even if you're kind of physically living, because that disfigurement is extremely damaging psychologically to the victims who do survive such attacks. And number five, the victims have so many needs which are left unmet after the attack that no country to date can claim that they have achieved the full cycle of justice, really, because that part of the equation, I feel there's a lot of it in terms of what governments can do worldwide to take care of burn victims and to provide them, you know, the adequate legal and medical attention that they do require financially as well, and then provide them livelihoods, etc., and then a place in society. So if you want to look at closing the gap post the attack, we're really far from you know, where we need to be.
So I think it's safe to say that there has been progress, like to see the specificities being addressed, such as the possession, sale and intent, that's great. But even with national and international acid crime legislation, the incidences of the crime still persist. So what do you think are the main inefficiencies or inadequacies in the legislation and its implementation?
Yeah, I think as a whole, acid crime legislation is definitely, I would say, Laila, moving in the right direction. Like I've explained, a lot of countries are taking note of this. And I think there's one particular model framework I really want to key in on, focus on, which I was very inspired by. In fact, which we got to see much later, but we got to see before the second version of my bill actually came out. So it didn't help me in the first version, but it certainly helped me draft a better second version of my bill. And I'd like to talk about this. The UN Women has done a very good model framework legislation on violence against women. And in this, acid has been addressed. And you can see a clear trend whereby national acid crime legislation are actually adopting this framework more readily. And this wealth of data which they provide is super useful. I mean, it's a good formal guideline for national parliaments if they were to use it in its entirety. And I think the problem lies here, that no country to date, unfortunately, can claim that they have done optimal usage of this model framework. And that once, I think, all countries who are badly affected by this problem can claim that, we'd be much closer to the, not to the finish line, but at least to getting some form of, real progress on this particular issue. I want to talk about some of the key provisions in the UN Women framework. Number one, the legislation needs to be comprehensive and multidisciplinary. Now, this means that it must encompass prevention, protection, punishment, survivor empowerment, and support. Now, that's a lot. If you just look at that, that's not a small agenda. And that is a comprehensive agenda. And it's, like I said, it's multidisciplinary. And this requires input from practitioners in multiple fields. Now, you could have activists, you could have lawyers, you could have doctors, you could have politicians, have surgeons, you could have law enforcement agents. There's a lot of fields that are working on this particular issue, like I said, because all these different layers or these practitioners need to come together for the actual delivery of the solution. And I think the documentary in Pakistan was a good example of this, because you got to see the issue from all sides. You got to see it from the medical side. You got to see it from the legislative side. You got to see it from the victim side, and the law enforcement side, the judicial side. So the issue is pretty complex, and it needs to have a comprehensive approach to it. Number one. And number two, the legislation needs to be gender sensitive as opposed to gender blind. And this means that where applicable, legislation needs to recognize that these crimes disproportionately do impact women. It needs to therefore address and account for the structures of patriarchy, oppression, repression, that specifically highlight heighten the female vulnerability. And these are, like we're saying, a very vulnerable part of society as such. Number three, there needs to be a specialized police and prosecutorial units in place. Now, agents involved in acid violence cases need to have adequate training in dealing with gender-based violence specifically. I do want to talk about some drawbacks and some challenges that I want to identify here, so that going forward, whoever's listening to this podcast, all the stakeholders involved who are out there, this is, I believe, after like I would say about a decade in this particular field, during my parliamentary days and even post-parliament, I would say there are certain drawbacks that do need to be handled. Number one, inadequate and inefficient implementation globally. No country can claim that they're green on this, you know, on the implementation side. There's a stark need to ensure the investigation process, the legal proceedings, the sentencing follow, you know, that the sentencing follows clear guidelines, regulations, and standards. And there needs to be consistency and clear penalties for non-compliance, which need to be strictly. Now, all agents must be bound by law to properly exercise their due diligence and must be adequately penalized if they're not doing that. And in terms of capacity building, I do want to talk about the fact that this legislation needs to be strengthened with adequate capacity building through activism, through awareness raising, and through institutionalized gender-sensitive training, which is on the lower side right now. This is essential to ensure that all agents are involved now, whether it's doctors, judges, police officers, investigators, they all need to be well-informed as to the specificities of gender-based violence. And other than this, the capacity building needs to involve state-funded collaboration with experts and relevant NGOs and adequate campaigning, etc. Number three, the legislation needs to be more adequately consider that the ease of access of corrosive substances, given how deeply entrenched their societal perceptions of toxic and violent masculinity are, as cyclical as it may sound, the reality is that as long as these substances are out there, are cheaply, readily available, these crimes, frankly, will continue. So there needs to be a real clampdown on that. There needs to be a more concerted effort to regulate the sale and the subsequent carrying of that substance. There needs to be institutional mechanisms for monitoring that carrying facility. Now, these are large ticket items, easily said, but not so easily enforceable. To enforce these in different geographical settings, it's not an easy task. And number four, the medical community, doctors, surgeons, nurses, specialists on burn cases. They need to be able to perform to their optimal using state resources, and I repeat, state resources for the victims without any bureaucratic and financial impediments. A lot of time, this is the bottom line, if you like, that if victims cannot have access to medical, the medical facilities in every country are different, but there needs to be some minimum bottom line where victims are assured that financially their medical expenses will be taken care of, because it does add up if they're not being serviced by the state as such. I want to give an example, Laila, at this point. The example is of July 2017, there's an honorable MP from East Ham, Stephen Timms, I believe is his name in the UK, and he led a parliamentary adjournment debate on this issue of acid violence, and he called for the UK government to reclassify sulfuric acid. Commonly, sulfuric acid, as you might all know, is used as a drain cleaner. So it's easily available as such. And he wanted that regulated substance and requiring a license for purchase. Now, this explains that there is a complete understanding of the gravity of the problem as far as the UK is concerned, and as far as other countries are also concerned on this particular point. And the Honourable MP then went on to further suggest that the possession of acid be made a criminal offence in line with the law on possession of knives. And so there needs to be more concerted efforts along the same lines as these.
So that's an incredibly complex framework. Multidisciplinary, I think, is the best way to describe it, like you said. In order to facilitate progress in the right direction, what role do you think non-state actors can play in the fight against acid violence?
I think this is an important area because, you know, my own journey, frankly, was facilitated by an NGO. It's called the Acid Survivor Foundation of Pakistan. It's led by Ms. Valerie Khan. And NGOs are often, you know, their role cannot be stressed enough in this fight. These are basically grassroots women rights organizations that are key to tackling violence against women. They're not just there to highlight issues, but they also are part of the solution because they take care of the victims, also these NGOs. And they ensure that they at least get some medical help, they get some legal help. And they are, in effect, the support and justice system of the victims. And they facilitate that such social practices, you know, that there's some form of activism against this crime as such. I want to give a few names here. I mean, just in the countries that we have been discussing, that we have focused in on for the sake of today's podcast. Bangladesh, there's the Acid Survivors Trust International, there's the Acid Survivors Foundation, there's the Acid Survivors Network. In India, there's the Acid Survivors Trust International, Acid Survivors and Women Welfare Foundation, the Mir Foundation, etc. In Cambodia, there's the Acid Survivors Trust International, the Cambodian Acid Survivors Charity. In the UK, there's the Acid Survivors Trust International, the Katie Piper Foundation. And in Pakistan, like I said, there's the Acid Survivors Trust International and the Acid Survivors Foundation Pakistan. And there's many others. In fact, the list is very long. I'm just giving a few of the ones that I'm particularly familiar with. But this list is long, thank God, and it helps capture, you know, it helps the victims reach out and they're able to get some form of help through these NGOs. Now, it all comes back to capacity building and spreading awareness and educating the masses on these issues and informing the vulnerable about their rights and putting pressure on governments and law enforcement agencies. And since we have discussed, Laila, that acid crimes are a form of gender-based violence, the key really is to tackling these issues lies in changing societal perceptions and understandings on gender-based violence. This is really a huge task, and we need to empower these women politically, economically, socially, so that we can bring them out of their positions of vulnerability and give them employment opportunities, give them shelters, and save them from abusive family dynamics. Often these are internal domestic violence times, you know, infinite, if you like, because a lot of these cases of acid violence are essentially, you know, local, internal, domestic as such, inside the home. Confidence building is key. And like I said, it's a two-pronged approach. We need to build women's confidence in themselves and in their ability to be self-sufficient and independent. And also increase their confidence in the criminal justice system, that if they do reach out after this crime has taken place, that they do perceive that in their particular country, they will get justice on this particular issue as such. And then, of course, it comes to the commitment of the state, how they protect their citizens and how they protect them and give them equal rights. I think in each national setting, it goes without saying that there needs to be coordination between different actors. Like I said earlier, medical facilities, governments, law enforcement agents, judges, NGOs, activists, survivors, of course. And the drafting of this legislation, it needs to be, you know, building safe spaces with survivors, creating designated burn units, etc. For this.
I think it's really interesting. You mentioned earlier about societal perceptions, and I just wanted to pick up on that. So do you think there's a bigger conversation here which stretches further than just this specific crime of acid violence?
Yeah, of course. You're right about that. There's a much deeper conversation which extends just beyond acid violence. And it's about gender inequality. It's about the societal and cultural perceptions and structures which perpetuate the kind of mindsets which lead to such acts. It's about an entire portion of our population which is vulnerable because of the deeply entrenched societal thinking that men are somehow perceived to be better, more powerful, more worthy than women. And these are the kind of mindsets which take away any and all accountability, and they perpetuate cycles of violence because somehow a man can get away with this act. As such, it's about his ego, his pride, his distorted notion of honor, which penetrates so many societies so deeply. So it's a conversation really about marginalization and women who have been stripped of their agency and their sense of self as such. So acid violence is just one form of gender-based violence, which is really huge in many parts of the world. And it's crucial to empower these women to combat gender-based violence. Women need to feel empowered. They need to be given equal opportunities to regain their agency as such. And like I said, we've started a reform process. We know where we need to get to. Zero tolerance for such crimes needs to be advocated globally. International leadership needs to, you know, zoom in on this and talk about these vulnerable parts of society. And we know how to get there. That's a bit of good news. We do have a legislative comprehensive framework, which we know we need to implement. We just need to do a couple of things, and I want to focus in on three. Number one, we need to coordinate internationally at such at all levels. Number two, we need to create acid crime control champions in the media, individuals who are champions in the media, in the legislation, in the legislatures, in the human rights activists, in the medical care community, in INGO community, in NGO community, in the student bodies, and in the victims' community. So champions who are going to talk about this, try and resolve it, and who can be used as you know, as projection for this particular cause as such. And number three, we need to see the process through till the victims actually get complete justice. We can't just leave it at, you know, the culprit got caught and he's behind bars for a few days, for a few months, and then that's the end of it. It needs to go beyond that. It needs to make the victim feel that, you know, the state has actually taken care of the issue till the end, which is their medical facilities, their judicial process, their rehabilitation in back in society, their livelihoods, etc., etc. There's psychological issues after this. So there's a long process, and that's the gap that we need to really fill. But like I said, it's a journey that has been started globally. It's a journey that we have made good progress on. As long as we can take care of all these issues identified, I think we'll eventually hopefully get there sooner rather than later and save lives, the save vulnerable people out there. And not just save them, but literally make them live another day and make them live with dignity. That's the bottom line, that they need to be rehabilitated back with dignity.
I think that's the perfect way to end. Thank you so much, Ms. Maimon, for such a comprehensive analysis of this extremely important cause. I truly hope this encourages our leaders to join hands in the struggle and for the momentum being built against acid violence to continue and to definitely be strengthened. I'd like to thank our listeners for staying with us, and I look forward to welcoming them soon for another episode of the Vulnerabilities Podcast. Till next time, I'm Laila Hamidi, signing off for now.